is Scott.
This is Pat.
Hey, stick around for this week's program. It's a good one. We got John Lynch, professor and director of Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making, is going to be joining us. Here's what's interesting about this. Does financial literacy equate to making better financial decisions? I thought so. You might be surprised by the study.
We also have a gentleman that calls the show and has a question about whether he should take a pension lump sum or a monthly pension, probably one of the largest financial decisions in his lifetime.
Yeah, stick around for Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Answering your top financial questions for the past 20 years, it's Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean. Thanks for joining us.
Glad you're here with us on this weekend as we talk about financial matters, good financial plan stuff. Both myself and my co-host, we're both practicing financial advisors, certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant. We spend our weekdays with people like yourself. Come here on the weekends to be your financial advisor on the air. So whether you're listening to us on a radio program, radio shows, radio station near your hometown, or you're listening to a podcast sometime during the week or whenever, we are glad that you're part of the show.
And so or if you're just sitting in your car while one of your family members is Christmas shopping, welcome.
Yeah, no kidding. Actually, if you've got this on a podcast as you're sitting there in the mall while somebody's shopping,
you know, they staring blankly into the wall at the mall.
Now, that sounds fun.
Yes.
It is that time, though, when you figure there's, what, a week left of shopping.
Yes. And good times. I'm almost done.
Huh?
I'm almost done.
My wife and I do most of our shopping. This is totally off subject, I understand, because this is a financial program. Most of our shopping online. I'll set a date with her, a date shopping. It'll be online.
Going to a store is painful.
No, you know, it's the malls overall are down. Not just the retail people going buying. Well, online shopping is hurting retailers.
Yes.
But haven't been around that long. But the big, huge malls, the indoor malls, those are declining. And
they're turning into lifestyle centers.
Yeah, where it's more outdoors and you pop from one store to the next store, which isn't kind of funny, isn't it?
Lifestyle centers.
Remember? Lifestyle centers.
Yeah, they call them lifestyle centers. They're like, you know, they've got the water fountain and people gather around there and the outdoor dining and that sort of thing.
You know, the interesting thing about that, from an investor standpoint, I try to take clues from everything in life, really. I try to relate this to what's that mean from an investor standpoint. So if you think about how consumers' appetites change.
Yes, and how they actually changed retail. Because retail shopping, when you went to the mall, was what you did to achieve a goal. Now what they're trying to do is to turn it into a dining.
Yes.
A dining, social, movie.
Altogether, right?
Shopping experience.
And the old malls that you would see, sometimes they would have some nice restaurants that usually weren't part of the mall. They were like at the corners.
Oh, yeah, very rarely. Parking lot. Especially the ones that were built in the 70s and the 80s.
The food court was horrible, just junk food stuff mostly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so now you get these cool looking centers. So you think if you decided to have most of your investments in old school malls, it has not been a good ride for you.
Which is why, as always, a diversified portfolio.
It's a reminder of how as the appetites for the consumers change, if you own anything that's related to the consumer, which consumer spending accounts for
most
65-70% of the growth in the economy and earnings for most companies, either you'll be able to figure out where the consumers are going, or make sure that you are not over-concentrated in any one particular place.
Correct.
That's the kind of thing that can really,
so
I think, get you into some sort of trouble. So anyway. Also, hey, there's been seen a number of stories regarding mutual fund capital gain distributions.
Yes, you see these popping up all over the place this time of year.
First of all, really, really, really quick before I talk about it. We do take calls in this program. If you'd like to join the show, we'd love to take your call, answer your question. Our number to contact us, 1-888-2-HANSON, 1-888-2-HANSON. Numerically, it's 1-888-2-HANSON. 242-6766. So, articles on capital gain distribution.
You see them all over the place this time of year.
Yeah.
And because mutual funds are, well, for most people, the average American, most of your assets are inside an IRA. So it doesn't matter what the capital, inside some sort of tax qualified plan.
Yeah, 401k, 403b, IRA. Yeah.
For most people, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, most of the listeners, that's where the majority of your assets are, inside your retirement account.
And for those that have it outside, I've changed my position on taxation over the years, which is, it doesn't bother me anymore. And the reason is, especially if you have an actively managed mutual fund. If you have a passively managed mutual fund, like an index fund, you're not going to see much in terms of capital gains.
Well, you
anyway.
Would not recommend having much in the way of actively managed funds outside of retirement accounts.
That is correct. But sometimes you have a little bit of my portfolio, but I don't pay any attention to it because I hired an active manager to buy and sell things. And what goes along with that is sometimes you're going to pay capital gains. That's just the way it is. What are you staring at me like that for?
I'm thinking how much of your portfolio you actually have in
very
managed funds, number one. And number two, outside your portfolio.
Very little.
Okay.
Very little. Very.
But I think your point there is, the funny thing is, we've had, so Pat and I have been doing this. Handsome McLean, we've been around since 1993. Pat
yeah,
and
we've
I
been doing it for.
We were working together before that. And what's amazing to us, I think, is that we'll have people contact us and they get frustrated
because capital gains.
Because they have to pay a capital gain on their investment.
Like, okay.
Would you rather have a capital loss?
I'd rather have a properly diversified portfolio. That's the most important thing.
And making money.
Yeah, but sometimes you have to actually, even on an index fund, Scott, sometimes you have to recognize a gain to rebalance a portfolio.
Absolutely you do.
And the cost associated with that? Is when you recognize a gain, you're going to pay taxes on it. Why do you recognize a gain?
Because you had a gain.
And I want a properly diversified portfolio.
And if it
requires me to sell something that made money, then so be it.
And I can't tell you how many times we've seen over the years where somebody doesn't want to sell a position.
And they hold on to it till?
It falls in value. Oftentimes more than the tax they would have had to pay and they incurred a capital gain.
The idea behind a well-diversified portfolio is exactly that, which is that sometimes you have to buy something and sometimes you have to sell something and reallocate the portfolio in order to keep it within tolerance of what your risk level is. And that's why it's okay.
And there are some funds, though, Pat, that distribute an enormous amount of capital gains relative to their...
Didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, some that there's one here. I'm reading this 34% of their portfolio distributing capital gains. It's the way the tax laws work, where they have to distribute capital. It'll be interesting to see what changes we see in taxes next year. But if
Trump, if
you've got your, if
what do
you've
you
got
think?
Your,
what do you think, Scott? I'm sorry.
Well, I'll finish this thought, okay. And then if you've got the most of your savings inside of retirement accounts, then it's irrelevant because it's not, you don't pay a tax.
What do you think? You think there's going to be big tax changes next year?
I do.
Do you really?
I do.
I don't think so.
You don't?
No. I don't think so.
Why?
I think there might be some big tax changes on the corporate level. I just don't
Foreign corporate tax, that's a done. Corporate tax rates are coming down.
Okay.
I'd put money on that one. There's no question about it.
So I just don't think maybe we'll see some relief for the middle class. Maybe for those people making less than $80,000 a year.
I believe there will be a tax cut, and I believe that the wealthy are going to benefit the most.
Do you really?
And here's why I say that, because that's what the first argument. Well, isn't that? And a couple weeks ago, Paul Ryan was on 60 Minutes, Speaker of the House, I'm trying to remember the moderator there at 60 Minutes was. Asked him a couple times, won't that favor the rich more? Well, look, if you got one person paying $1 million a year in taxes and another person paying $100 a year in taxes, and you tell them both, look, we're going to give you a 20% break in taxes, the guy paying $100 a year just saved $20. The guy paying $1 million a year saved $200,000.
Well, they were treated as equal as a percentage.
But that's not how it ever gets spun in the media. It'll be that the tax... that the greatest share is going to... Matter of fact, that guy was 1,000 percent more.
I disagree. I think that what we're going to see is that we're going to not see a big drop on the income, the higher incomes. I think you're going to see it more concentrated on the $80,000 to $100,000 and below.
Well, here we are. We're coming to the end of 2016. Scott believes there will be a tax cut next year.
Pat
believes. So if you want to look at, you know, some predictions for the year, I will predict there will be a tax cut.
I think that they'll probably get rid of this 3.8% surtax on net investment income, which was part of the... It's not the Obamacare. Again, it's the Affordable Care Act.
Why does that frustrate you?
Well, because if it
turns... There's the Roth IRA named after Senator...
Roth.
I don't know what his first name was. There's a lot of things named after individuals. See, now you don't know why. They should like the Obamacare tax. The term.
Okay. I'm not... Okay.
But I think last week I mentioned on the program, on Obamacare. It's the investment surtax. Thank you for the proper use of the phrases there, Pat. I apologize for having...
Well, what happens if they get rid of Obamacare...
The vocabulary of the average person in this country.
What happens if they get rid of Obamacare and keep any or... All of this 3.8% surtax.
But Trump and care, those two things don't go together.
No.
They couldn't call it Trump care. Anyway, all right. Well, I think, it's time for us to talk with our guest. So on today's show, we've got John Lynch. John is the professor and director of the Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making. So he helps people make good decisions financially at the University of Colorado in Boulder, which is a beautiful place. And John's talking to us today about couples and the financial planning decisions that they make and they make together and how they do that and that sort of thing. So, John, we appreciate you being part of our program here at Hanson McLean. Welcome.
Thanks, Scott.
Oh, good. There we are. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing here in regards to helping people making financial decisions.
Okay. So at our center, we do research about trying to understand what causes people to make good or bad financial decisions.
And we've all made bad decisions financially, right?
Yeah.
all of us have. We all have things that we've been embarrassed about. It's one of the things that's interesting is, as we meet with as financial advisors, sometimes people are reluctant to share some of their stories because we're all a little embarrassed about some of the financial decisions we made. So continue on.
That's absolutely true. And so we've been interested in the issue of like how the quality of people's financial decisions depends on something called their financial literacy. So their financial literacy is often measured by their financial knowledge, where they understand basic things about compounding, about inflation, et cetera, and how that relates to financial behaviors, like whether they save for retirement, whether they have problems with debt, et cetera.
And so, there's a lot of talk here in this country about the fact that a lot of our kids graduate high school without any sort of financial education. You can get a doctorate from a university without taking any sort of classes on finances, et cetera, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's kind of how I got in this entire field. So I was at a conference of people who were kind of the world-leading experts on financial education, and they were talking about the issue of whether states should require high school kids to take a class in financial education.
And so one would presume the more education has regarding their finances, the better financial decisions they're going to make. Is that correct?
One would assume, and it turns out that's just not the case.
Really?
Yeah.
Go on. Explain it to me, please.
Yeah. Well,
that's what's interesting about this research, frankly, John. That's why you're on the program today at Hanson McLean. But yeah.
It seems totally logical that, the world has gotten more complicated since the time that, say, I came into the workforce to people coming into the workforce today. You need to know more just to cope. And so, therefore, a solution is to give more financial education. But basically, what the research shows is that financial education has minuscule effects on the quality of people's financial decisions, surprisingly. So we did what's called a meta-analysis, which is a summary of everything that's been published on the topic of all studies looking at the effects of financial education on the quality of financial decisions. And what we found was that on average, kind of getting the education offered versus not only explained about 0.1% of the variation among people in whether they did the good thing or the bad thing. So it's significant. It's in the direction you'd expect, but it's surprisingly small.
I'm having trouble understanding. So it would seem to me that if I learn about how auto loans work, for example,
that I would be able to decide to get a auto loan that is more favorable than not.
And is that not the case, at least 90% of the time?
You'd think. So like one of the things that happens is that that whatever financial education happens decays over time. And so what this study showed is that there's no evidence of any financial education of any length, like I say, a high school course or anything of, in any other format, after, say, 2 years. And so if you imagine, for example, that taking a high school course in financial education is going to help your kid make a better decision about an auto loan, say, 4 years later.
By the way, that's exactly what I made my daughter do. So, senior year, I made her take a particular class that was going to have some financial education in it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good to know.
I mean, that was a couple years ago. So,
yeah. And I think part of the thing is also that beyond kind of knowing the facts, there's sort of personal skills and habits that may have more to do with whether you make good or bad financial decisions, whether you have self-control, et cetera. And so I think the premise of financial education has been that it's a problem of knowledge, where it could be other things like, things people talk about, grit or self-control, et cetera.
Or self-esteem.
Or self-esteem, yeah. There's a set of, there's a whole array of things. In fact, I just was at a talk this morning in the finance faculty about self-efficacy. So if you believe you can control your financial outcomes by your actions, then you're much more likely to behave in a responsible way.
I believe people can control their financial outcomes.
Well, of course you do. That's what you do. Well, you do what you do.
I think you're right. So you've also done some work in this area when it comes to couples, right? And most of us in this country have a partner, a life partner, or married or whatnot. And
John, I can tell you. So Scott and I've been doing this for almost 25 years. I can't remember how many times, because it's been a number of times where I actually said to the couple, "I'm going to give you a couple minutes alone," and got up and walked out of the room because they were going at it some sort of subject. And I quite frankly,
weird. Couples arguing about
weird about it is they're doing it in front of
which is
a little weird.
Yeah.
But I can't even imagine what it would look like when I wasn't there. So, and I always think to myself, I'm not going to be able to fix this, right? I'm just going to share my opinion. But if they're going to go at it, I just got to get out of there because there's no benefit. So talk a little bit about that, about the couples.
Okay. Well, so in this area that this, you know, pretty big literature about financial literacy and how it relates to financial behavior, it turns out that almost everything looks at people just as individuals and ignores the fact that they're in couples and so on, in relationships.
All the research out there.
And so it does turn out to be the case that if I measured how much you know about financial matters, it does, your test score on that does predict how well you do in various financial behaviors. But what we found was that when couples get together, and they kind of divide up roles in the marriage for different kinds of things, including money, the person who gets to what I'll call the household CFO role knows about exactly as much about money as the person who doesn't get that role. So it's not like the person who gets the household CFO role is the person who naturally has an aptitude toward money. But what we find is that the longer the couple stays together, the more the person who's in the household CFO role gets smarter and smarter and smarter about money over time.
Okay.
And depressingly, the person who's in the non-CFO role gets, but worse and worse and worse over time, basically by relying on the other partner.
So, that would be my marriage. Been married almost 25 years. My wife has a degree in finance.
Yeah.
If I asked her today where the Dow was, what the price of oil was, what our economy's been growing at, she would have no concept.
Yeah. And so it turns out that
she totally relies on me. And I know that happens to a lot of couples.
And I'm not going to share my opinion of my wife on the radio.
I love my wife dearly. I'm just, it's interesting how you state this. And I've realized that in my own marriage. And clearly we see that with the couples as well.
Yeah. Well, what we find is it's interesting that, I guess, first of all, we find it interesting that in your marriage, it sounds like you got this household CFO role. You're both were pretty capable at the start of the marriage, but somehow you divvied things up. And now over time, you've gotten to be more and more sophisticated and she's got less and less sophisticated.
That's right.
And that happens in a lot of marriages. And what we find is that, that paralleling that issue of how the longer you're together, the more one person gets better and better at financial knowledge, the other worse and worse. The person who gets better and better at financial knowledge does, in fact, turn out to be better and better at being able to answer financial decision problems or make good financial decisions, like, for example, the auto loan example that we were talking about earlier. So it's like in my marriage, it turns out my wife was a CPA in a former life. So she's the one that does the day-to-day household kind of things and so on. And so what the implication of this is for your listeners is that on the one hand, it's very functional for one person in the couple to be the money person. But the longer you rely on your partner, the more you're putting yourself in a kind of a vulnerable state.
It's so dangerous.
You know, exactly right. And yet, you know that every marriage is going to end in either divorce or, death of one of the partners.
Yeah, everyone. Yes.
And so that relying on the partner may be very functional in the current situation, but eventually it can be a problem.
And, it's interesting because it isn't uncommon for someone to manage their own portfolios, a husband and wife with a husband, at least in the 60s or 70s, which is the clients, a lot of what we see is the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but especially in the 70s, to manage their portfolio their whole entire life. And when they are diagnosed with some sort of an illness that may shorten their life expectancy, they will go out and find an advisor because they don't want their wife to have to make that decision for themselves.
That's interesting.
Not unusual at all.
Yeah, and I guess that raises an interesting issue because if they find an advisor with motives that are aligned with the client, then that can be really good. But you might also imagine a situation where they weren't so foresightful, and let's say there's that the person who was the household CFO is incapacitated, and now the other person, on his own or her own, they gotta maybe find a financial advisor to help them through that. They may not be able to tell the difference between a good one and a bad one, given that they've been relying on the partner.
That's right.
Yeah,
if they just rely on someone's charm.
Yeah, we see it. We see it all the time.
What are some best practices then you think for couples when it comes to their financial planning, John?
Well, I think it's interesting because what the data show is that that how well the household does in terms of making good financial decisions depends on how much the CFO knows, the household CFO knows, and it's completely independent of what the non-CFO knows. So in other words, if I'm relying on my wife, how much she knows is what matters, how much I know turns out not to matter for how things are going along now. So in that sense, there's not like a prescription that, you should necessarily divide things 50-50, et cetera. But basically, once there's some transition point, it's a major problem if you've been relying on your partner for a really long period of time. And so, if there's some early warning signal at what you describe your clients doing is pretty smart. That's pretty foresightful. It also turns out to be the case that when people have a forewarning, they can start learning. So, there's a study of studying people whose one partner got Alzheimer's and the CFO got Alzheimer's. And the study shows that even if you've been relying on your partner for quite a long period of time, you can start to get up to speed.
But you're only as good as the CFO in the relationship. So if the CFO in the relationship loves to spend money and not save for retirement, that's the best you're going to get.
Yeah, well, that's basically that's what the data show. The data
don't
show.
Don't delegate to the spender then.
Don't delegate to the spender.
That's rule
this
number
has
one.
Been, this has been well worth the time. If you're dating a young lady that loves to spend money.
Or a young man.
Or a young man. Or whatever relationship you're in. It's up to you. Just
leave.
Don't delegate any responsibility to the one that spends the money.
There you go. Thank you very much, John.
Hey, so John, we greatly appreciate being on the program today. It's that's actually had some interesting stuff. And we've got a link to this research and to more on this at moneymatters.com. So if you just go to our website, moneymatters.com. Again, it's been John Lynch is the professor and director for the Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making, the University of Colorado Boulder. So thanks so much, John.
Thanks, John.
Glad you
thanks
joined.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Glad you joined us today. And, you know, it's, Pat, really interesting. When it comes to education, when my daughter had her fourth grade review with the teacher said she's good at this. She says the one thing she doesn't know her money yet. And my wife said, and her dad's a financial planner, for crying out loud. Hey, we got to take a quick break. Stick around for more Hanson McLean.
Taking the financially complex and making it simple. It's Hanson McLean's Money Matters at 1-888-2-HANSON.
That's right. If you want to join us, 1-888-2-HANSON will get you on to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. 1-888-2-HANSON. Of course, Pat, we've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
We're coming upon our 1,000th show. We're actually doing some research to figure out what the exact date is. But
what the exact date of the 1,000th show?
I think it's probably sometime in the next year. We began doing this program.
Are we having a big celebration or 1,000 shows?
We might.
Champagne and balloons, cake, Costco cake.
Costco cake and some cheap champagne. Sounds lovely. Yes. What a wonderful party. So we've been doing, I remember my daughter turns 21 this Christmas Eve. She's a Christmas Eve baby. And I remember we started doing the program she was born because I was in the hospital as my wife was in labor as you were doing a radio program.
Yeah,
it was our first Christmas. And, you know, the first year in the radio show, we were trying some different things to try to...
What do you mean you're trying different things? We were trying anything.
We were trying anything. Can we get someone to listen?
We're trying anything.
So Pat interviewed Santa.
Yes.
And figured out what Santa's financial planning was.
Santa was played by Lou Gasecki.
Yeah. I don't know if he's still in Sacramento, but he was a great help to us in the early years. But
we're Facebook friends.
Well, then you're close.
We are.
Yeah, he must be pretty close then.
I'm pretty close.
Facebook friends. So you see his stuff every once in a while.
Yeah. He goes by Lou Gallagher on the radio, I think.
Lou Gallagher.
Sweet Lou.
And he's got a great radio voice. And he was Santa, played Santa.
Yes.
For Christmas.
You weren't there. You were delivering a baby.
No, I was actually in the hall listening to the program as the baby was being delivered. Missed the delivery. But Santa was great. You and Santa were phenomenal. Yeah, I was in
Didn't
the hospital.
You have a kid that was born on New Year's Eve, too? Or
New Year's Day.
Oh.
One was New Year's Eve. One was Christmas Eve, and one's New Year's Day. They both get it's not good for their presents. Particularly my daughter. And she turns 21 this year.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, there's not going to be any bars open on Christmas Eve. I mean, Christmas Eve is her birthday.
Oh.
A lot of times people are 21. Not that I condone this sort of thing, but... They might go out and have a drink on the 21st birthday because they go to a bar. But the only bars that are going to be open on Christmas Eve
probably
not the kind of bars that I would want my 21-year-old.
Yeah.
So I think she's going out at midnight on the night before just to go have with her cousin to have a little celebratory drink.
Oh, that makes sense.
I guess. Why am I talking about my
daughter? My son celebrated his 21st birthday in Ecuador. I said, we going to go out? He goes, what? You think you need to be 21 to drink in Ecuador?
You think they have a really look at your ID close?
What's
so you said, well, son, I guess you're gonna have to wait till you're done with college and you're back in the States for that first beer.
He's like, Dad, you think that I've been here for 6 months? You think I haven't been to a bar or two in Ecuador?
Anyway, so we're not gonna interview Santa this Christmas,
no,
although we're
and
close
you should
to Christmas.
Thank us. Thank us. Thank us.
So,
oh, you know what? By the way, speaking of Christmas. And that,
what did you get me for Christmas?
Oh, I was thinking about the
same
article I recently read about. We talked about it a couple weeks ago about the Charitable Gift Trust.
Yes.
The Donor Advised Funds. And a National Philanthropic Trust report came out. And contributions went up 11% in the year 2015. So we talked about this a couple weeks ago about how it's easy to donate.
Donor Advised Funds,
assets.
Think of them as they're like a private foundation that you don't need to have a lot of money to go in it. Now, frankly, you could have millions, hundreds of million dollars in a donor advised fund. It still might make more sense than a family foundation.
It most certainly would be less expensive and would give not quite so much transparency.
Donor advised funds, as the name implies, a donor advises the charity where to direct the dollars. You can set these things up through most of the major financial institutions have these, as well as regional community foundations will have these as well. And you can get it, contribute assets or cash to it, receive the tax deduction in the current year, but you don't have to necessarily give away all the dollars that current year.
You don't actually direct it to a charity until some point in the future. $22.26 billion went in the year 2015.
How much?
$22.2
billion. $22 billion went into donor advised funds last year. And a bunch came out, too. Went to different...
How much came out?
$15 billion or so. I read the article. I remember the number somewhere in there.
Yeah, $14 billion.
And there's about $80 billion or so in the donor advised.
So
it's the end of the year.
It's a great thing to use if you're charitably inclined and you're looking for a tax deduction.
And particularly if you think that... Tax rates
are going to go down.
Now would be the year to make a deduction on those.
Yes.
There's some other tax complications and rules regarding those. So before you rush out.
Check with your tax advisor or at least someone that pretends to be a tax advisor.
I don't know about someone who pretends to be one. That might not be such a good idea. But anyway, they are.
But you wanted to talk
about. I've used them in the past. And I think they make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I do. So. Anyway, let's take a call from one of our callers. And again, if you want to be part of Hanson McLean, simply call 1-888-2-HANSON. Numerically, it's 1-888-242-6766. Again, 1-888-242-6766. And we're going to talk with Kevin. Kevin, welcome to Hanson McLean.
Hi, guys. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling, Kevin.
Yeah, my call is about converting a 401k balance to a Roth IRA. I picked up somewhere that I had a particularly attractive chunk to do that with. It's an amount, it's in the mid five figures that represents after-tax contributions. Our plan is funny. They only let you designate your contributions in even percentages. So in order to hit the max, I always overshoot by a bit every year, and I've been doing this overshooting for over 20 years. I'm currently in that phase now. I kind of forget about it, and then my checks in December come up short. But in any event, I have this amount, and I'm wondering.
You have some contributions that have been in an after-tax format. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And how much? Not all 401ks, for the rest of the listeners, not all 401k plans allow this, but some, and typically it's probably a large employer and it's probably an older plan, been around a long time, I guess.
Yeah, it has been around a long time. It's also annoying it doesn't automatically default into the over 50 bucket, but you have to jump through a bunch of hoops to, direct your contributions there. So I just kind of let it go.
So how much do you have in after-tax contributions in this plan?
As I said, it's a little over 50K.
Now, is that the balance of your after-tax contributions?
Or the contributions?
Yes.
That is the market value of the, over all these years that's being tracked separately, the after-tax contributions. So this is the current balance, which would represent the amount of those contributions plus whatever growth there's been.
Okay, so
the growth there have been, that's the key term here.
How old are you, Kevin?
Mid-50s.
Okay, and what's your question for us?
Question is, somebody told me that that was a particularly attractive balance to roll into a Roth.
Yes.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, what I really want to do is confirm if my understanding is right, and that, I guess, it's particularly attractive because the tax you would pay is not on the entire $52,000. It's on the growth portion as opposed to the basis, if you want to call it that, the contribution amount.
Well, you don't have to pay any taxes at all to roll this over into a Roth.
Of the contributions.
No. Of the contributions.
So here, you're correct here. So what you've got going on is this. Let's just make it. Let's say your. Let's say that after tax balance is $50,000. And for the rest of the listeners, if you look on your statements, if you have any, you'll know it's there because it'll state after tax. But if you assume your contributions are $20,000, and $20,000 you've already been taxed on. The $30,000 in growth you've yet to be taxed on. Now, right now in the 401k, let's assume that you never contribute another dime again. And let's just assume that the 401k just sits there. And now 10 years down the road, that $50,000 balance, let's assume that's now $100,000, right? So we've just had an additional $50,000 of growth. Because it grew in the 401k, that additional $50,000 of growth is all going to be taxable to you.
And in a Roth, it would not be taxable to you.
So in a perfect world, if we could take that $20,000 contribution and stick that into a Roth IRA and then allow the growth to occur there, whatever growth occurs will be tax-free.
So remember, taxable. The difference is you only want to roll over the contribution amount to the Roth so that you have no tax implications whatsoever.
So you
now
are
saying that.
You are in, so what's unique about these dollars, it allows you the ability to transfer into a Roth without any tax consequences whatsoever. You can essentially take a balance that would have been, you would have the earnings taxed and move it to a balance where the earnings will be tax free. Here's the problem you've got.
Here's the rub.
You still are employed by that company, correct?
Correct.
And they may not allow you to do what's called an in-service rollover. Have you checked on that?
No, but that was a question I was going to ask you guys, not whether it was permitted, but whether many plans might not permit it, which I suspect might be the case. I would have to find
out. Are you comfortable telling us the name of the company?
Your employer?
I'll tell you the name of the plan administrator at Schwab.
Yeah, that's kind of almost irrelevant. But every company is different. So check with your employer to see if they allow for an in-service withdrawal. If that's the case, you can transfer some portion of this.
Now, here comes the second rub, right? So let's say they...
if we just answered your question, theoretically, yes.
It'd be perfect. Yes, it's allowed by law. But here you've got two things that you need to worry about. One is, do they allow in-service rollovers? Okay, let's come back, and if they say no, then forget the conversation completely.
And then you got to wait till you're 59
and you got to wait till you're 59
and
a half.
You can do it at 59 and a half.
But let's say they say, yes, we do allow for an in-service rollover. Then you have to go back to the plan administrator and say, how much money do I need to roll over to capture all $20,000 of that contribution? And it may be half of the plan or a quarter of the plan.
Or all of the plan. Which they may not allow.
Which they probably don't allow. So, while we answered your question, you are no further ahead than when you joined us.
Yeah.
Is he?
But you know what? Here's the thing. Here's what I see happen sometimes. And here's what some of your coworkers could do, Kevin. You go, you end up retiring, you roll out your 401k, you get this check for $20,000 for your after-tax contributions. Instead of having those dollars go into a Roth and spending some other money, people throw away that opportunity, take the $20,000 and deposit it in some other account, and it gets spent, and that's money that could have been into a Roth IRA.
So, Keith, two things. Excuse me, Kevin, two things. One, do they allow in-service? If the answer is yes, how much money do you have to roll into an IRA get to that?
Then you can decide, is it worth it if I have to roll out 70, if I have to roll out half my plan, is it worth it? You can make that decision at that point. If they don't allow it or it's not worth it, then just simply wait till you're 59 and a half, and then you can transfer it out. We're all still employed.
You can transfer it out even if you're still employed and they don't permit in-service withdrawal.
Once you're 59 and a half.
After 59 and a half.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know because that milestone is coming up all too soon.
Yeah.
and every year comes quicker.
Okay.
Yeah. Coming. One other question. The plan does allow for, we have a Roth 401k as well.
Yeah.
Which I haven't utilized.
You should.
I wonder if I could roll it into the Roth 401k.
I don't actually know the answer to that, but you might be able to.
That's a great question. I don't know.
I have no idea.
Theoretically.
But that's theoretically, the only person that would be able to answer that is the plan administrator.
And it's not in the first call you have with somebody is going
to
be a
go way up the totem pole to get the right answer to that.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't really contribute. I would not contribute any more to the after tax portion.
I think he's got that, don't you, Kevin? You're not putting any more after tax money in, correct?
Well, I am currently. Because again, if I want to hit the 18,000, I can either undershoot it or overshoot.
Well, then use overshoot in the Roth.
Yeah, use the Roth
for a couple percentage.
Yeah. Unfortunately, what I'll probably do is I'll probably just adjust my wife so we're each contributing 18,000. I'll drop mine down below 18.
And there we go.
Okay, so that'll be a workaround. But it sounds like the key here is what we want to focus on transferring is the amount that's represented by the contributions, total balance.
That's exactly it. Yes,
that's
yes.
all you can.
Yeah, yeah.
That's I mean, no, you can convert more to Roth. It's just taxable.
Yeah, it makes no sense to do it now.
Yeah. And there's no advantage to doing it now versus later, assuming taxes stay the same and all that for that tax portion.
Well, the sooner you can get your contributions into a vehicle that allows for essentially tax-free income in the future versus taxable, the better you're going to be. But
no, I'm sorry. I meant the taxable portion.
Yeah, we don't know what your tax liability will be in the future.
So exactly. So it's kind of a
bet. Yeah, it's a mute point. We know that it's probably going
to
be lower in retirement.
To you
What's that?
Yeah. Are we arguing? Over nothing, yeah.
Okay, all right. We appreciate the call.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad you called. That was funny. You guys both know what you're talking about.
We do or don't.
You did, yes. You're both on the same page there.
All right.
He's like both just talking over each other.
I have a brother named Kevin. We're Irish. We like to fight over things.
just for the sake of fighting.
Inconsequential. My brother Kevin, yeah.
After tax, it's been a long time since I've even seen anyone contributing to an after tax.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand how his contribution, when he was making sense of this last 2%.
But if you... don't put any money in an after-tax 401k.
There you go.
Period.
There you go.
Right? I mean, it doesn't
make simple enough.
Don't put any money into an after-tax. And now that I say that.
Don't put any money in that.
No, there could be some time if someone employer does not allow for a Roth 401k.
Why would you make a non-deductible IRA contribution and convert it to a Roth?
Because you might have other IRAs that's going to preclude you from that conversion.
All right, so let's go to the 1/100.
So that's what I'm just saying, that in most things in life, you can't stay
never or always. Yes.
So never do that again, and we'll be fine.
I'll always do that.
All right. Anyway, this is kind of ridiculous. So anyway, I think it's time in our program to talk real advice. Our real advice portion of Hanson McLean's Money Matters is when we talk to a financial advisor of Hanson McLean, one of our Hanson McLean's own financial advisor, and hear from them story that they have with working with an individual or a family, and some of them came to them with a financial need or a problem, and that they worked with them and helped them solve their situation that they're working on. And this is not necessarily indicative of all clients at Hanson McLean, and every situation is unique. But anyway, today we've got Keith Johnson, and Keith is one of our Denver-based financial advisors. Keith's got over 21 years of experience in financial services, so he's got a lot of experience. He is a certified financial planner and meets with clients throughout the Denver area. And Keith, welcome to the program.
Thank you, gentlemen. How are you?
We are great. We are glad you are taking some time to join us today. So tell us about your situation.
I met with an individual a couple months ago. Basically, he reached out to us. He had one main concern or question. He's getting ready to retire early in 2017. Wanted to know how to take his pension. So he has two different options. He can take it in monthly payments or a lump sum. He had actually visited with another advisor, and the advisor recommended he roll this money over into an annuity product where he could guarantee him 6%.
So that means that rather than take the company pension, they take the lump sum, give it to this advisor, and the advisor then uses an immediate annuity, or what is kind of an annuity do they use?
Well, he actually proposed three different options, one being a variable annuity and one being an index annuity. So I wanted to drill down a little bit more with him in regards to that 6%.
Yeah.
Because
sign me up.
In this interest rate environment, sign me up for it, right?
Right, exactly.
So he was kind enough. He brought everything in for me to review. And going through everything, I found out that it was basically an add-on or a benefit to this annuity product where regardless of what was happening in the stock market, his money would grow at a minimum of 6%. So when I pointed out the costs associated with this, totaled everything up, it was close to 3% to own this contract, had limited flexibility and withdrawals and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the road we went down with that.
So how the 6%, how long would they pay 6% for?
They will pay basically what it was is he bought purchased this rider or this add-on to the annuity for 1%. And the money would grow at a minimum of 6%. And then 10 years into retirement, he could start taking monthly payments off that based on whatever the account value was at that point.
Yes, but not today. Not immediately.
Not today. It's locked up right now.
So what was your recommendation to this person to do? So none of these annuities made sense. This person came to you. Did it make sense for them to take the monthly pension or the lump sum? Which was the best thing for this client to do?
It did. It made sense for him to take the monthly income of $3,000 per month.
Not the lump sum. It made sense for him to take the monthly pension and not the lump sum?
Yes. And I ran two different calculations, two different scenarios showing the lump sum and then showing the monthly payout. And it was clearly more favorable to take the monthly payout of $3,000 from the employer, because what we did here was between that and his and his wife's Social Security benefits, they are able to pay for all their fixed expenses in retirement with those assured lifetime income sources, or those income sources that never run out. Mm-hmm. They're always there. Plus, the couple has $1.5 million in IRAs and 401s, where if they need long-term care or something happens, an emergency, a roof they need to replace in retirement, they can go to that. So we talked a lot about balance of income in retirement, and that really resonated. So why do we need another X amount from a variable annuity 10 years down the road? There was just no need for it.
And it made sense for them from a risk standpoint to take the monthly pension.
Oh, absolutely.
So, just the return. I mean, a lot of them, this day and age, Pat, it's just the return. You look at these, so lump sum sounds good until you got to go invest it.
Correct. So what happens for the rest of the listeners when you meet with an advisor at Hanson McLean? Every situation is different. And so some companies, it makes sense for them, you to take a lump sum. And some companies, it makes sense for the people to take a monthly pension. Every company's pension
That's
is
right.
different. Every single one. Also, it's dependent upon what other assets you have, what your health is like, what your spouse's health is like, and what pension options they give you at the particular company. So,
and one thing this other financial salesperson they talked with, I imagine whatever products they recommended that did not match the $3,000 a month the company could provide. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes, because you're not going to get a better deal on the outside as far as pure fixed income. Match risk to risk. Now, there are times when it still might make sense. Some say I'm willing to take on the investment risk by taking the lump sum and investing it myself, which is fine. But you're not going to get a commercial annuity. Commercial meaning something that a retail, an individual can buy. That's going to have a better rate than the company. So unless somebody's got a terminally ill or something along those lines, the monthly pension of the company.
And a joint and survivor. So what happened to the other advisor? Just the guy said, I can't talk to you again, which would have been actually the smart thing for the client to do, to say, take your high commission products and hit the road. Is that what the client said?
Essentially. It was interesting because we met back up before his second appointment with that advisor. So going through, if anyone's read a prospectus, if you can't sleep at night, they're over 100 pages. They're very entertaining. But I went through all of that, met with him, basically armed him with some questions to go back at. And after we circle back after that second appointment, he's elected absolutely not to do that.
Yeah, well, as he should. So,
well, hey, Keith, appreciate you sharing that story with us. And thanks for being on Hanson McLean. And thanks for being part of the Hanson McLean team in our Denver area.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. And Merry Christmas. Can we still say Merry Christmas? Is that
we can. It's our radio show.
Oh, Merry Christmas then, for crying out loud.
So, you do anything you want.
You know, it's interesting.
Well, almost anything you want.
Full disclosure. So Hanson McLean, we've got over 4,000 clients, households that we work with and serve. I think, and that could be off by a number too. I think in the last 12 months we recommended annuities in like five times, something like
that. Not many times.
Out of 4,000 households we serve, so there's almost every once in a while there's the right opportunity, but it's pretty rare. So if you're working with, you go to talk to somebody in their first, we talked about this on the last week's program.
Show.
Of when someone offers a product solution, And here, this poor guy's looking at, should I take the pension or take a lump sum? He goes and talks to some advisor, a quote-unquote advisor, and the advisor pitches him an annuity product right off the bat. And this annuity product supposedly pays 6%. Nothing's guaranteed 6%.
Nah.
It's smoke and mirrors. It's like they got three cups upside down.
You knew it when...
15 years ago, you could find some products like that. This is a different interest rate environment.
Yeah.
Here's what I know. The building we're in right now, this building... was purchased with a loan from an insurance company.
Yes. And what is the interest
it's
rate on that?
It's below 5%. I forget the exact rate.
It's right
rate.
Around 4.
Yeah, I think it's 4 1/3 or 4.5. Let's call it 4.5. It's below 5.
I don't think it's quite 4.5, but it's around
4. It's below 5%. So an insurance company. So I know when an insurance company, and they lend it
to us
for buying the building. For
see?
Crying
huh?
This little
what's
bald guy.
Poor decision making there.
So... if they're earning less than 5%, I just know that they can't be offering more than 6%. I'm sure. Not that good with numbers, but I can figure out that one, right? So yeah.
It just isn't there.
It's not there. So anyway, I think it's always important to, I think it's important to talk to somebody who's a fiduciary, fee-based approach, so they're not going to be just selling you product to try to generate commission.
And
those equity index annuities certainly pay fat commissions to, they have a high YTB.
Yield to broker.
Yield to broker.
Big surrender charges.
So don't, 99% of the time, you don't need them and they don't make any sense. And actually, equity index annuities, I think there's never a case for them and we've never recommended them.
Actually, and if you're, we have on our website a couple little videos about annuities. So if you go to moneymatters.com.
Yeah, if you want to learn more about how they work, moneymatters.com, we've got a little video on, I forget what we call it, but it's, if you search it,
moneymatters.com.
And also, by the way, if
our weekly email.
If you're not receiving our weekly email, you should receive our weekly email because it's a great email each week. We always have a little, and oftentimes there's a little short video of something from our radio program because we do this program. It's a videotape, so you can smile and wave at the cameras. And so feel free to get that. And if you don't have a copy of my book, Great Christmas Gift, Last Minute Item.
Christmas Gift.
Christmas. Oh, fantastic stocking stuffer. MoneyMatters.com/book. 75% off discount there. /book. MoneyMatters.com. All your friends and family would love you for that. Anyway, we're out of time. We'll see you next week. Merry Christmas.
This program has been brought to you by Hanson McLean Advisors. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice, and you should consult your own financial advisor or conduct your own due diligence.